What was that? A formal challenge to battle?
Own life is a game, Miss Turlock. Only here in Hong Kong, we play by different rules.
Ah! In one step, we have reached heaven.
We've managed to stay on top for the past 150 years. We plan to stay there.
White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 346. Welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we are joined once again by the art director at White Rocket and awesome artist and podcaster and good friend, Jared Albrecht. Welcome back aboard, Jared.
Why, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here, Taipan. I brought the other half of my coin.
Ah.
I'm ready to do this.
Ah, but is it the real one? You have to prove it to me that it's the real other half of the coin.
Oh, I got it straight out of John's koi pond. We're good to go.
I thought that's where he was keeping it. Okay. Well, we're here to talk about the miniseries Noble House that NBC broadcast in 1988. And by extension, the awesome James Clavell novel from the early 80s, that a book that's so long that I just opened it to the middle, and I'm realizing if you're on page 728 of this book, you still are only like halfway through it. That's how huge a book it is. It's a humongous book, but Clavell's books are all huge, but they are fun to read. You want them to be that long when you're reading them because you don't want it to end. You want it to just keep going forever. It's kind of like he would write a series. He would just fit the entire series into one volume, you know?
It sounds like it. I've never actually read any Clavell.
Well,
I know you're a big fan, and since you and I have become friends, I've watched King Rat.
Yep.
And Noble House.
Yes.
So that's pretty much my experience. I've seen Shogun, but I was really young. I need to see it again.
Yeah, see it again. It's so good. And then the thing with Taipan, Taipan is very much, I compare Taipan, the miniseries, well, it's a movie. That's the problem. It looks like it was filmed like a miniseries and cut down to 2 hours for a movie, but it's De Laurentiis. It's not NBC. The problem with the Taipan adaptation, let's just say, is it's like the Dune 1984 movie. It looks really good, and clearly they spent a lot of money on it, and the cast is really cool, but the script is terrible. So it just, you can't fit a 1,200-page book into a two-hour movie. It just, you know, it's like if they try to do The Lord of the Rings in an hour and a half. It just, you know, it just doesn't really work. But
am I crazy, or did De Laurentiis have a hand in that Dune movie?
Yeah. Oh, everything that De Laurentiis ever did, 9 times out of 10 at least, it was a disappointment. De Laurentiis, they would buy a property, they'd license a property, and they would make a movie out of it. Sometimes they'd even spend some money on it, and it would just be disappointing. They put a lot of effort into like the cast and into the sets and everything, but they just never had a good script. It was the same problem with Dune. It's the same problem with Taipan. So, yeah, but I never thought about it before, but it really is. I mean, Noble House is like if he wrote 10 140-page novels in a series. In other words, it's like if Roger Zelazny's Amber books were put out, well, they are, as one big book. It's like if they'd originally been written as one big book. You know, some people break stories up into little volumes. Some people just write the whole big thing as one giant brick, and that's what this is one giant brick. But we're going to talk mostly about the video adaptation of in 88 from NBC, and we'll kind of, you know, I've read the book now twice. In fact, this time I listened to it on Audible, and it gave me like a solid month's entertainment at all hours just listening to this giant epic, you know. And by the way, this is the kind of thing you want to get on Audible, because for the price of, like, you know, one, you know, you could if you go to Audible with one credit, you could get like a 150 page book, or you could get something that's going to last you a month. So, yeah. You know, this thing probably should have been like $100 if it was on CDs, and I got it for one credit. So, you can't go wrong there. But so you had seen King Rat,
yes,
fairly recently,
per your recommendation.
Yeah, and you we just to watch, right? We weren't planning on reviewing that one, but we can touch right on it a little bit too if we want. So you, what did you expect going in when I said, see, because for the audience, this is how I presented this to Jared, basically, is, you know, I was basically like, well, you already know that Clavell's pretty cool because you really liked King Rat. It's a sort of a modern historical fiction, but, you know, we're big James Bond fans, and this thing stars mm-hmm. Pierce Brosnan right back a few years before he became Bond, and it's also got John Rhys-Davies. Mm-hmm. Who's a Bond veteran, and it's got a couple other people. And I said, you know, and it's kind of got some international espionage stuff, though not as much as the book, but the miniseries still has some of it. So I kind of laid out for you reasons why I thought you would like it, and then you mm-hmm. went off and watched it. So what was your kind of overall thought about it going in and then coming out? And then we'll go into more detail.
Okay, going in, it was the same thought that I have when you send me a lot of things. You like to send me things that are really long and really time consuming.
It's true.
And as I tell you in our private texts, you're very much the college professor, always giving me homework.
Yeah, well, I give you way more homework than my students.
That's yes. So, well, obviously you were like, check this out. It's some Pierce Brosnan stuff. And I was like, you know, I'm always down for that. Cause like you said, huge Bond fan. Mm-hmm. And you were big on it. You didn't steer me wrong on King Rat. So I was like, okay. And so I get it. I look at it, and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. It's like, what was it, 6 hours?
Well, it was 12 with commercials. So you got the short version that didn't have all those long commercials. It was like a 12.
Essentially four 90-minute
yeah.
Episodes. I was like, oh, my goodness, 6 hours. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just kind of nickel and dime this. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So going into it, I was really just going into it off the strength of Pierce Brosnan. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. And I did enjoy King Rat. And I'm a big fan of sort of broadening my horizons when it comes to film in general. And I was like, okay. Hadn't seen it. Frankly, hadn't even heard about it. Didn't know it was a thing.
Okay.
I'd heard about Shogun. I think Shogun was like a huge hit in the 80s.
Yeah.
So knew about that. Like I said, I'd seen it, but I saw it basically in the 80s, so I was kind of a kid. I need to see it again. So I was like, okay, let's check it out. So that was my thoughts going in, kind of open-minded. Coming out, I'm glad I watched it. It was very interesting, very good. With its length and some of the nitnoid things, I'll pick at it.
Right.
Overall, though, I thought it was really good. But due to its length and some of those nitnoid things, is it one of those things that I'd go back to watch again? Maybe not, but don't take that as I didn't like it. I absolutely liked it. It's just a big time commitment.
Right. I think I've watched it probably three or four times now. I tell you what, it's just, you know, it's in my wheelhouse in several ways. I like big historical epics. I love Pierce Brosnan's charisma. You know, this was around the time he was doing Remington Steele, and while he was waiting to be Bond, you know, several years later. And it's just, he really commands the screen. He was even younger here, you know, and he commands the screen, and his charisma, his confidence. It's just fun to watch this one character dropped into like a insoluble situation from five different directions, right? I mean, he's got to deal with international espionage. He's got to deal with a financial crisis. He's got to deal with his big rival who's coming after him, trying to ruin him. He's got, you know, so many things, this American company coming over he's trying to do a business deal with, but are they stabbing him in the back? He doesn't know. He's got kind of a romance possibly in the offing with Deborah Raffin. There's so many things he's trying to deal with. You know, I've heard reviewers say that if a week in Hong Kong is like this, then you'd be worn out after a month, you know, because there's just so much going on. But
Yes, yeah. He did cram a lot in several days.
He does. But I just...
Well, not even several days, in a handful of days.
Just a handful of days. But it's something about the way Pierce Brosnan carries it off. And he's very much like his performance is just spot on from in the book. And it's also, I just love the idea that he's not a government official, he's not a military official, he's not a rock star, none of that. He's just a businessman, and yet in Hong Kong, business and finance is so important that everywhere he goes, and you see a little bit of this in the miniseries and a lot more of it in the book, everywhere he goes, he is treated like royalty. You know, everybody deferred. Oh, Taipan, you know, here, have the best seat in the best table in the restaurant. You know, oh, Taipan, here, you get the best car. You have the best house. You have the best office building. You know, everything about it is like he is the man, you know, and he really, I think that Brosnan carries that off, you know.
Definitely. I got that feeling, you know, it was one thing to see all the business people, oh, Taipan this and Taipan that. But what like the cops.
Yeah, even the cops.
Oh, hey, Taipan. I'm like, how much juice does this guy have?
Oh, he's got a lot. He's got a lot. Yes, exactly. Well, let's give a quick summary. And the basic idea of it, for those that haven't read it or watched it, is that, all right, well, in the book, it's a week in late October, early November. No, it's in November of 63. It's right before the JFK assassination, but you never get to that. You just know that's coming. And so it's this sort of idyllic period where, you know, it's still Camelot, but it's over in Hong Kong. There's a lot of optimism. There's money being made. You know, it's post-World War II. In fact, in the book, there's a lot of references to World War II. Most of the male characters served in World War II. Brosnan was a fighter pilot in World War II and got injured, and then he became a race car driver after that. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, like I think in the miniseries, the only time they really touch on that is when Quillen Gorn is driving his car and it crashes. You know, somebody's tampered with it. And in the book, there's a sense that Ian Dunross, Pierce Brosnan's character, Dunross thinks that he had a crash in a race that made him have to stop racing because Gorn messed with his car. And so it's never clear whether Dunross ordered that car to be sabotaged to kill Gorn, and it didn't, or whether, like, one of Dunross's servants did it just to kind of curry favor with the boss. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I was in the miniseries. I was a little like, wait, now who did the brakes thing?
It's never clear, right? And in fact, at one point, I think in the miniseries, at one point, Dunross says to his butler, you know, he says, if I want second foreign devil's brakes tampered with, I'll give the order. So I think
I do remember that. Yeah.
I think they kind of insinuate in the miniseries that it wasn't Brosnan that did it. But in the book, it's left very, very gray because he's a very ruthless guy. I mean, you know, to kind of continue the summary, it's a blood feud that goes back 200 years to when the founding of Hong Kong, that basically in the Clavell verse, Hong Kong was largely founded by Ian Dunross's ancestor, the great green-eyed devil Dirk Struan. And so he set himself up as the Taipan, the supreme business leader in Hong Kong from the very beginning. And so Quillen Gorn, that's John Rhys-Davies, his ancestor was always kind of second. And so there's this blood feud between their two families where Gorn's family is always trying to, like, murder, you know, Dunross's family, the Struan family, and become the number one family and the number one business. And Dunross's family is always trying to fend them off, you know what I mean? Keep them at bay. And so you jump from it. In the Taipan story, all this is happening in the 1840s. And then we jump to the 1960s, the novel, and the 1980s in the miniseries. And let me ask you this. This is one of the things I liked about in the miniseries. They made it more contemporary, probably just to save money, you know, because you didn't want to have to go back and use 60s cars and costumes and everything. Why not just use 80s stuff? What did you think about it as a kind of a – at the time, it was filmed as just a contemporary drama. But looking back now, it really is kind of a period piece about the 80s Reagan era big money excess. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I I get what you mean. When earlier, just a few minutes ago, when you revealed to me that the book takes place in the 60s, my initial thought was, kind of wish they'd done that with the movie.
Yeah.
Because one of the problems with it is it being so 80s-centric, which is fine. It definitely has that Reagan-era 80s vibe to it.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that holds it back, because it does play like a big episode of like Dynasty or Falcon Crest at certain points.
Yeah.
And I think that is not to its advantage. I think if it had been more of a period piece, that could have been avoided. Mm-hmm. But, you know, given budgets and time constraints, I think for what it is, not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and interesting too, because in the 60s, when the story is set in the 60s, it's very much like the Cuban Missile Crisis has just happened, just like a few weeks earlier. And there's a lot of, you know, Castro in Cuba, there's a lot of Khrushchev, and it's just a very intense time in the Cold War. There's a new U.S. aircraft carrier that sails into Hong Kong Harbor that's a big part of the story, and there's a whole lot of like 60s Cold War stuff. Whereas in the 80s, you still have the Cold War going on, but it's a different time. You know, it's not, you know, it's like the difference between GoldenEye and Dr. No. You know what I mean? It's just a different time for spying and spy. It's like the 60s spying era with the Soviets and everything was more nitty-gritty, you know. It was more down to earth. It was more guys running around with fedoras and sunglasses and all. I think it would have played out cooler if it had been more of a Mad Men era vibe to it, as opposed to, like you said, Dynasty and Dallas. So, well, so over the course of the story, several things happen, but the main one is, in fact, I would say the backbone of this story is, here is Dunross trying to manage Struens, that company, the Noble House, as the Taipan. He's trying to just get it through, you know, another year as the number one house. And this American power couple, they're not really together, but they're a power couple, the Taipan of Parcon, which is an American company, Link Bartlett, and his assistant, his like his second in command, Casey Chalik, and that's played by Deborah Raffin in the miniseries. They come over to Hong Kong to try to make a deal, and you don't know which side they're really on. So what was your reaction to Link Bartlett and Casey, and what did you think they were up to and what was going to happen there?
I first met the characters, I thought, well, Casey's obviously the love interest, and she's going to end up with dreamy Pierce Brosnan, because how could you not? So that was my original thought, although I liked the way they played her character. Strong, savvy businesswoman of the 80s, but not like a lot of times in order to show, especially with female characters, in order to show strength, they come off as very angry or bitter or very demanding, or not sure what the right word I'm looking for is. Very aggressive, I think, is probably the right word. And they didn't have to do that with her. She was able to remain very, very classy, very beautiful. She didn't have to have a super forceful personality, but you still respected her and her decision making. So I thought they balanced her character really well. And then as far as Link Bartlett, the most unlucky guy on the planet.
Oh, man.
Well, let me rephrase that. The most unlucky billionaire on the planet.
yeah, no kidding.
When I first met him, he was an enigma. What's he doing here? But I think in short order, it was just kind of like, he's not really playing sides. He's not out to destroy anybody. He's just there to get the best possible deal for himself. And
yeah,
although I will say that when it comes to him, he's another one of the, I think, detractors for the series for me. Just the actor himself. I don't think he's a bad actor or anything, but he came off as very, like, he's the one of all the characters, I thought he came off the most Dynasty.
Okay.
I don't know. He just felt very American primetime soap actor to me.
Yeah. And it doesn't help him that the character was written that way by Clavell, even in the book, where they make a big deal out of he likes beer in a can, you know. He doesn't want wine or whatever. He's like, they're serving pasta and they bring him out his like Budweiser in a can or something, you know. They really play him up as he's not a complete, you know, stereotypical ignorant American blundering around in Asia with Europeans, but he's not super sophisticated either. He's very, very savvy, but he's also pretty crude in a lot of ways, you know. And the thing with him for me was, for him, from his perspective, like you said, he's just there to make the best deal for him. He's not worried mm-hmm. about who makes out well in Hong Kong. It's none of his business. Mm-hmm. But see, we go into it rooting for Dunross, you know, rooting for Pierce Brosnan, rooting for the Noble House. And I mean, you like Quill and Gorn just because John Rhys-Davies is so awesome, but you still know he's kind of the bad guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we're rooting for Pierce Brosnan's side, and we're wanting Bartlett to help Pierce Brosnan. But yet, mm-hmm. you can also understand why he may not. And so it's kind of like, you're like, come on, Link, get with the program. Help the good guy. But then you're like, well, I understand. It's not any skin off your nose. Which one of them wins? Why does he care? You know? And in fact, there's a lot put into the whole idea of, Casey starts to figure out, right? She pretty quickly starts to figure out that Pierce Brosnan is the long-term way to go, and Gorn is kind of like, he'll make you some quick cash, but do you really want to be in bed with him, perhaps literally, you know, for a long run? And Bartlett is still kind of like, well, I hadn't got to get in bed with him, so I'm not really, you know, I'm not as averse to that as you are, Casey, basically. So it's frustrating in a way, because you're wanting Bartlett to make, quote-unquote, the right decision, and yet you understand why he's being pragmatic about it, you know.
Right, the way he plays it, and you know better than me, but I did a little research before the podcast, and mm-hmm. as I understand it, in the book, he's a lot more likable.
Yeah.
And because of his sort of, I don't care, I just want what's best for me attitude, and like you said, as watchers, we're rooting for Brosnan. We're like, come on, Bartlett, be Felix Leiter here, man.
Yes, exactly, exactly, yes.
But as I understand it, and again, it's just based off what I've read, you'd know better than me, that apparently he's more likable in the book than he is in the movie. He's not like not likable in the movie. He's just kind of there. You know, I'd be more interested in your take on that based off of what I read.
Yeah, no, I mean, he is. I would say that I can't think of his name right now, but the actor plays him. Ben Masters, right. Ben Masters, not a huge name. I mean, he's okay, but they spent so much money making this, they had to take what they could get in terms of the cast, and he's fine. I mean, he's okay, but and so is Casey. He just basically in the book you get a lot more depth. In other words, in the book they spend a lot of time on the relationship between Bartlett and Casey, and this whole deal that they've made. Now, bear in mind, in the book, it's 1963, so whatever she was doing in a man's world in the 80s, it's even that much harder for her in 1963. Like they make a whole big deal in the book about how she walks into the boardroom for the first time to meet with all the Struens guys, who are all these old-world British old money, you know? And they're just like, oh, are you here to serve us tea? You know, and she's like, no, I'm here to negotiate. And they're like, oh, so you're going to tell us what Mr. Bartlett wants to do when he gets here. And she's like, no, I'm here to negotiate. And they're like, wait, I don't understand. It's like she's speaking Bulgarian. They don't understand. They're like, so you're here to bring the papers that he wanted you to bring so we can see what he's going to say when he gets here. And she's like, I'm here to negotiate. And they're like,
What flavor is the tea?
Yeah. Right. What language are you speaking, lady? We can't understand you. It's so funny. But yeah, in the book, it goes into how the two of them basically made a deal several years earlier that they want to make money, right? They want to be big business. And so they merged. He had a big construction company. She had like an optics, like glass, like Lens Crafters or something, basically, right. That she had taken over.
They talked about that in the miniseries.
Yeah, and they merged them, and they made a deal that they would not allow any romantic interaction between them for X number of years, and that time is running out. So in the book, they make a lot out of the time, you know, the time is running out, and in a couple of months, we're going to have to decide, do we want to get together or do we not?
And that is interesting.
Yeah, and Casey has pretty much decided that when that time runs out, she wants to get together with him. And until they came to Hong Kong, Link had pretty much decided he wanted to get together with her. And then he meets Orlando. played by the wonderful Julia Nixon. I've met Julia Nixon. She's a delight. She's wonderful. She was in Babylon 5. I think you and I have seen an episode where she was in it.
I thought she looked familiar.
Yes, and she was actually married to Hutch from Starsky and Hutch for a while, too. Julia Nixon is perfectly cast in this role because she's supposed to be a Eurasian, part Portuguese, part Chinese, who was a lover of John Rhys-Davies when they were younger, and then she did something that made him mad. I won't go into all the details. And so he still, like, supports her and looks after her, but he doesn't love her anymore. And so he's using her like a big distraction, right? He figures if Link Bartlett is obsessed with this gorgeous Eurasian woman, he won't make as good of a deal, you know what I mean, as if he was clear-headed. But what happens, of course, is that Orlando and Link totally fall in love with each other. And that also leaves Casey in the position of, I have to support Link. I love Link. I want what's best for Link. I really hate this Orlando woman, except, man, she's really awesome. I like her, too. I don't blame him, you know. So you get this really interesting love triangle there, too. And then it's kind of like a love quadrangle because Ian Dunross is getting interested in Casey, too. So there's a lot of romance going on. There's a lot of business going on. One other thing I'll mention real quick, in the book, there's a huge espionage subplot. I mean, half the book is the Russians, the Chinese, the British, and the Americans, like a giant James Bond story. In the miniseries, they really pare all that down really to just Brian Kwok. So let's talk about that for a second. Unless you have anything else you want to add about the love triangle, quadrangle thing, what about the Brian Kwok spying stuff? What did you think about all of that with Inspector Superintendent Armstrong and all that?
The only thing I'll add about the love quadrangle is that Julia Nixon is gorgeous. Yes. Anyways.
Oh, man. You fall in love with her in this thing, don't you? She's just amazing.
Yep. She's great. But, yeah, the whole espionage angle with Brian Kwok, a.k.a. Chew Toy.
I know.
Chew Toy.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, you scamp.
That was kind of interesting to me because when I'm first getting invested in the miniseries, I'm like, okay, what am I watching? Okay, after about, you know, X amount of minutes, I'm like, okay, I'm watching an 80s business kind of soap opera-y thing. And then all of a sudden, there's a spy story plot right in the middle of it.
That's right.
And which also works well, even like you said, the book is 60s and in the movie it's 80s. But, you know, 80s Cold War stuff definitely still plays well.
Yep.
And the actors, I thought, did really, really well. The guy who played Brian, I'll try to pull it up on my iPad, which, of course, went to sleep the second I wanted to use it. Yeah, I'm not seeing it here.
Lim K. Tong is Brian Kwok.
There you go. And Gordon Jackson played, like, his partner and friend.
Yes.
Those were very strong performances.
They were.
Like, both of those guys were incredibly strong. To the point where sometimes we'd be back and doing the boardroom things and we're going to sell this many shares, we're going to do this. And I'm like, what's going on with the chew toy, man? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like from the miniseries point of view, it was like almost too strong of a subplot because I'm like, can we get back to what's going on with it? They had him like in the room, like basically like mentally torturing him and all this stuff. And I was just like, man, it was very interesting. So, yeah, that whole subplot, which ends up, at least in the miniseries, not sure about the book, being a huge hinge to help Ian Dunross get what he needs in the end.
Yeah.
Was intriguing. And like I said, I think a lot of it has to do with the strength of the actors. And there was another actor whose name I'm not going to remember who played like Gordon Jackson's boss. And he was real stern.
Dudley Sutton.
And he was strong. Like that whole subplot had super strong actors.
All right, let me touch on a couple of things there, because I love what you were just saying there, and there's a couple of things I'll add. One thing about it is this is Hong Kong, which was still a British colony, okay? The Chinese were kind of second class there. The Eurasian Chinese that were like, you know, longtime associates like Philip Chin and John Chin, all them, we'll get to that in a little bit, but they're a little higher up, you know. Mm-hmm. But the Europeans kind of still dominated, the British. And so it was a big deal when a Chinese, ethnically Chinese person would rise up high in the ranks of like the police. So that made Brian Kwok's situation even more poignant and important. And here's what the deal, for those that don't know what we're talking about. There's like these two police buddies. They're the, you know, the inspectors. And that's Superintendent Armstrong and Brian Kwok. And Brian Kwok is super like British Chinese. Like he's buddies with the Taipan. They go to the races together. They go out for drinks at night. You know, I mean, he's really plugged in with the upper echelons of the European ruling class, basically. And Armstrong is more of like a Columbo type, you know, more like a Peter Falk, you know, he's kind of like the rumpled old, you know, aging cop, but they make an interesting pair, like the glamorous young Chinese inspector and the kind of rumpled old British one working together. But they're really good friends. They have a bond. And then what happens is you find out that Brian Kwok is actually a secret agent working for the communist Chinese all this time, and it falls to Superintendent Armstrong, his buddy, to break him and get him to confess and hand over all the secret information he has. So it's, in a way, it's a very exciting spy story, but another way, it's kind of a sad story about, you know, this mm-hmm. friendship that gets destroyed because of who they're, you know, the political dispute between communist China and the British and everything. And but like you say, it figures in important later because Dunross will need the good wishes, the goodwill of communist China to kind of help bail him out when nobody else will. When Gorint takes control of all the other banks that would have helped him, you know. The other thing that I think you would find really fascinating in the book, Dudley Sutton is basically just playing Inspector Cross as the boss, right? He's the one telling Armstrong, you got to go torture Brian. He's not Brian, he's Chew Toy, and you got to go chew on that chew toy.
And that's that chew toy.
That's right. And that's about all that Cross does in the miniseries. But Jared, in the book, Inspector Cross is probably the single most interesting character, and they had to ditch all of that, which was really the that's the single most disappointing thing about this adaptation. They get everything else, I think, very right in this. But in the book, you keep getting separate chapters where Inspector Cross, who's like the highest-ranking British policeman, basically, like the chief, you get chapters where he goes and visits Russian agents and his buddies with him and hands over information to him and is like this super double agent. And all along, everybody says there's a mole. It almost turns into Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Everybody knows there's a mole in the British police, but they're like, well, it can't be Cross because he's so high up and everybody hates him. I mean, he's such a hard case, you know, he would never be. And then you get these chapters, he goes and meets with the Soviets and hands over information. You're like, oh my gosh, Cross is the mole. And it twists and turns, and then there's another twist after that, which I'm not going to give away for anybody that wants to read the book. But it's really an interesting spy story just with Cross alone, even beyond what he is involved with Brian Kwok and Armstrong. So
he's a secret agent on whose side?
Exactly, yes. Oh, man. If I had my soundboard working, I could hit that, but it's not working. So, yeah. So you got the whole cool British-Russian spy thing going on, and that's cool. Also, I want to ask you what you thought about the Chinese subplot, because you got several Chinese characters that have their own little worlds. One of them are the Chins. Okay, if you go back to Taipan, here's how it all began. I don't think they ever really explained this. Dirk Struan, who founded the Noble House in the 1840s and founded Hong Kong, he had a British wife. And from her comes the Taipans line. Like, Ian Dunross is descended basically from that. But he also had... But she died in the plague back in Glasgow when he's in Hong Kong. So he has a Chinese mistress, Mei Mei. And a lot of the Chinese characters, a lot of the Eurasian characters come descended from her. And she was awesome. So I root for all of her offspring. But then before her, we are told backstory, Dunross had a Chinese mistress before Mei Mei, and they had a son named Gordon Chin. Okay, Gordon Chin was a young man in Taipan, but by the time of Noble House, we find out that Gordon Chin was like the greatest businessman ever. In fact, in a perfect world where ethnicity and legitimacy don't matter as much, Gordon Chin should have been the second Taipan. The whole thing should descend through him because he was brilliant. And Gordon Chin basically set up the Chin dynasty as this shadow Struans family of Chinese Eurasian characters, right? And they just dominate Hong Kong in the shadows. They work with the triads, the organized crime. They are billionaires, right? And so, but they're still like second banana to the Taipan. And so Philip Chin, their descendant, is the comprador, like the Chinese assistant to the Chinese world for Pierce Brosnan's character. Okay. And so that's why he has one of those coins.
Now, okay, so that's Burt Kwok's character.
Burt Kwok from the Pink Panther
Who's
and everything.
Amazing.
And from, I think, Goldfinger, right?
Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice.
That's right. So did they present it in such a way that you could grasp, a normal person could grasp the whole thing with the coins, the half coins?
I'm not going to claim to be a normal person. But
I mean, a normal viewer that hasn't read it, I mean, yeah.
I grasp the fact that the coins, okay, basically I guess that they were important. They were part of the ancestry.
Yeah.
If you had a half of a coin, you had a lot of power because the Taipan had to grant you whatever request you had at the time of presenting the coins. Now, all the backstory behind that and the splitting of the families, that might have got lost on me.
Sure.
But what I took from it was Burt Kwok and his family were basically the... You said use the word comprador.
Yeah.
I was thinking that they were an intermediary to kind of help bridge cultural.
Yes, pretty much.
Things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much.
And that Burt Kwok was just a good friend, and the families went way back. Now, yeah, all the other levels of intricacy was probably lost on me, but I got those basic points.
And they're not like, critically important, but as far as the coin goes, what happened was, One of the several main plots, because these books are all huge and have main plots, but one of the main plots of Taipan back in the 1840s was that Struans was going broke again. They're always going broke. Every time we look at them, something's going on. And John Rhys Davies' ancestor was twisting the screw that time. And so Struan had to produce a large amount of cash money to pay off some debts, or they were done. And so Struan had no choice. He had to go to a big Chinese wealthy family and get a massive loan of silver to pay off the debt. Okay, and so the Chinese family, who were related to the Chins, the name was Jin Cha, he basically told Struan, I'll give you this money, but you got to pay it back with a small amount of interest, and here are four half coins. Whenever, any time in the future, you or your successors are presented with the other half of one of the coins, you have to give a favor of whatever that person asks, period.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. And so, at the beginning of this story, Philip Chin had the half coin. Then there's the whole subplot with John Chin. So John, his son, goes off to America, gets corrupted by corrupt America, right?
Hell yeah!
Flies back with, that's right, flies back with Bartlett on his plane. And John Chin has made some kind of a secret deal with Bartlett to give him leverage over the noble house. And that is, he's going to go steal the coin from his father's koi pond, as you pointed out, and use it to force good terms of a business deal between Dunross and Bartlett, with John as kind of reaping the benefits of being the middleman. Unfortunately, what happens to John before he can do any of that?
I believe he gets kidnapped.
He gets kidnapped by a bunch of incompetent idiots.
Things go south.
Mm-hmm.
John makes the business end of a shovel.
Yep.
Oh. And, I won't ruin it for the listeners.
These rich people, their heads are so soft.
Yeah, the werewolf. I think was the name of the kid.
The werewolf. Oh, the werewolf.
Is that in the book, by the way?
Yes. Oh, and they make a big deal. It's funny how like these four like ne'er-do-well idiots claim to be the werewolf, and so next thing you know, all over Hong Kong, everybody is terrified of this genius criminal enterprise called the werewolf. He's like the Taipan of crime. Yeah, it's like if the worst supervillain in DC Comics, suddenly everybody thinks he's the Joker, you know? Oh, everybody's terrified of the werewolf. He's everywhere. He has eyes everywhere. This is he's 4 inches in a shack. Crack me up. But so John Chin is no longer around, and now the bad guy, these idiots end up with the coin.
And they don't even know what it's worth.
They don't have any idea, but the guy puts it around his neck, and then Philip Chin, Brooke Kwok, he goes to Four Finger Wu, the old Chinese godfather, basically, on his little boat. And he says, I need your help getting my son back. And so Four Finger Wu isn't able to get John Chin back alive, but Four Finger Wu's flunkies find the coin. So now Four Finger Wu has the Chin family's half coin, and now Four Finger Wu goes to Dunross and says, I have the half coin. And what do you remember what he wants Dunross to do?
Basically wants his help in the drug smuggling business.
Yes, he wants to get into the white powder or heroin or cocaine or whatever smuggling business, and he wants the greatest shipping company in Asia, the British, you know, Struans, to basically smuggle heroin and cocaine for him. And, you know, Dunross is like, that's very bad, Joss, that we really don't want to do that. Think of something else. And he's like, no, one coin, one favor. I want I want this. And so what we really need at this point is for Four Finger Wu to have a horrible accident and die. So James Clavell will deliver that for us. Because every Clavell book ends with some big, I guess King Rat is the only one that doesn't. King Rat, let me put it this way. Every James Clavell book, you spend 95% of the book getting to know the characters and their situation, and in the last 5% of the story, something happens to shake everything up, right? And you see how it falls out. In Shogun, there's an earthquake. In Taipan, there's a landslide. In King Rat, the war ends and the British and the American troops show up, right? Shake everything up. In every one of them, something happens at the end that says, all right, you've seen the status quo, now deal with this. Okay. In Taipan, there's a hurricane. So there's something big that happens in every book that sort of takes the board and shakes it up one last time before the end game. So here it's the landslide, which we'll get to. So I want to keep bringing all of our threads together. So we've talked about most of them. We've talked about Dunross and
Man, we're talking about Venus Poon.
Oh, Venus Poon. Oh gosh. Just when
you think Pussy Galore is the most outrageous fictional name, comes Venus Poon.
She's the Asian Pussy Galore. She's played by the awesome Tia Carrere.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like this glamorous TV newscaster actress. And in the miniseries, they really just play her up as every stereotype of she's got a fancy dress and big hair and she carries a little dog with her, you know, like Legally Blonde or something.
I've kind of forgot she was a newscaster. I thought basically she was just a high-priced hooker.
Oh, well, that's how she comes across. Yeah, in the book, Clavell makes a lot in the book out of like when there's the landslide, she's there with a TV crew and she's like, actually she's in the building. Or no, she leaves the building and I can't remember now. She doesn't get killed, does she? I can't remember.
I don't think so.
I feel like she leaves. Anyway, maybe it's the fire. There's two disasters in the story. There's the fire on the restaurant boat, and then there's the landslide. Well, anyway, at one point, Clavell has her out doing a newscast, and she's just like bossing people around, and they're like, okay, we're about to go live in 3, 2, 1, and she's like, oh, there's been a terrible disaster here, and I'm reporting live. You know, she's just, she's like the sympathetic, you know, newscaster reporter on the scene at the disaster, crying about it, and, you know, and but she's very good at it, and so everybody wants her. Oh, and that brings us to another love triangle. There's Venus Poon, and Four Finger Wu comes off his boat to go have an affair with her. Do you remember who he has to shove out of the way, basically, to get to Venus Poon? I love this character.
Oh, it was the other Asian guy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another banker.
He was cracking me up, too. What the heck? Richard, who was that guy?
Richard Quang. Okay.
Richard Quang.
Here's the deal. Richard Quang is kind of a hapless doofus, but he's very rich and he owns the Hopak Bank. Which
the
is
bank
like,
guy, that's right.
Yeah, he's like the biggest Chinese banker. There's the British banks and there's the Chinese banks, and that's your two choices, basically. And then there's the Bank of China, which is the Communist China Bank. Okay. And they got more money than God. But anyway, so Richard Kwok, I mean Richard Quang, I get Bert Kwok. Richard Quang is the Chinese banker, and his bank is the one that Quillen Gorn, the main rival to Pierce Brosnan, decides to make an example out of to show Bartlett how he can disrupt finances in Hong Kong. So basically, Quillen Gorn, John Rhys-Davies, causes Richard Quang's bank to bankrupt, to crash. And so he does it for several reasons. One is to make a demonstration to the Americans, right? This is what the power I have. Don't you want to be with me? He also does it because he wants to absolutely put Richard Quang in a box where he has no way of surviving financially unless he accepts all the terms that Quillen Gorn lays out. And what that means is he has to vote on the board of whatever big corporation or whatever bank. He's on another bank board. He has to vote against Ian Dunross. See, so Quillen Gorn crashes Quang's bank so that he is at the mercy of Quillen Gorn and has to work with him against Ian Dunross, even though he doesn't want to. It just puts another vote on Quillen Gorn's side and against Ian Dunross, okay? But the funny part of it that we were talking about is Quang keeps having to tell everybody, oh, we're fine, everything is fine. And he's bringing his jewelry and mink coats to Asia, to Tia Carrere, to Venus Poon. But she knows which side of the bread is buttered, you know. And so she's getting over with Four Finger Wu, who's super rich, even though he lives on a little leaky boat. And so you get these great scenes like where Quang comes up and says, you know, here's your fur coat, my dear. And Four Finger Wu is like, thank you, Banker Quang, for bringing her coat. Now she's leaving with me. I just love it. Four Finger Wu just is so dismissive. He just smacks Richard Quang around. And
poor Quang, man. His bank's being taken down. He's trying to hide this affair from his wife and not doing a really good job.
No, because he wants to go out in public with Venus Poon. That's the whole point, is he wants to show off, look who I'm with. And she just in public is dissing him, you know. So, yeah, he's not rich enough for her anymore. I think that's all the main plot, main characters and plot threads going along. And so
I have one question.
Yeah.
And it has to do with Four Finger Wu of the Seafaring.
The Seafaring Wu, yeah.
Seafaring Woos, that's what it was. The only other character that I think the only character we probably haven't mentioned, because we've mentioned a lot, is his son.
Oh, yeah.
Who eventually will rise to power. And if we don't want to do spoilers, we don't have to talk about how. But he will eventually rise to some amount of power. My question is this. He was a charming character. He was the son of a mobster who didn't really want to be a mobster.
Yeah.
Is what I got from that. But here's my question. They made a big deal out of Four Finger Wu telling his son, now don't call me son, pretend you're my nephew.
Right.
And I was like, why? I've never understood why that was. Like, was he just trying to protect him?
I remember wondering that too when I rewatched and reread the book a couple of months ago. You're right that the miniseries never explains it. I think in the book it has something to do with. I feel like in the book it has something to do with if the Europeans, if Dunross and Gorn, if they know he's his son, they would treat him differently and they would expect different things out of him. They would think his loyalty would entirely be to Wu, that he wouldn't be trustworthy to have in their companies, you know. And so I think
maybe they'll speak more loosely.
Yeah, and give him more power and authority and everything. I mean, there may be more to it. There may be more to it. I'm forgetting, but I think that's part of it. Is that Four Finger Wu just doesn't want the Europeans to know how tight they are? Okay, I think that's right. But they call Paul Choi Profitable Choi, And the book, a lot is made more about him, how he went off to America and he, you know, had a good education, went to like Harvard or Stanford or whatever, and he came back and he doesn't want to become a crime lord. He wants to be a, you know, like a businessman in Silicon Valley or whatever. But he's very savvy. He's very good at like making good deals. And I think that at the end, Ian Dunross kind of senses that. And so even though Dunross terribly resents having to be forced to deal with him, in fact, I think that, you know, Pierce Brosnan has a great line where he says to Paul Choi something like, if you will take this coin back and not demand this of me, we can do great business together. And mm-hmm. Paul Choi thinks about it. And in the book, he thinks about it a lot. And you kind of see his mindset, which is what, you know, the advantage a book has. You can go into more thinking about stuff. But he finally just says, no, I want to do it this way. I want this, this, and this. And I want us to do it that way. So he does, you know, use the coin. But
I'd be very interested to see, because they really planted that seed that Pierce Brosnan was like, hey, I don't think this is what you really want. And the guy gives a little thought and he's like, this is what I want. And okay.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see what happened after that. Like,
well, the only thing we know, because I feel exactly the same way, we have very little after this because Clavell wrote two more giant books after this before he died. One of them, I was very disappointed because it was set in the 1860s. It's basically set in the last samurai period. Mm-hmm. And so it's about the Struans in Japan dealing with samurai. It's a good story, but it doesn't advance the story. You know what I mean? It's more like a prequel. Mm-hmm. It's like if you're really wanting Star Wars Episode 9 and we got Episode 3.5, you'd be like, oh, come on, you know? But there's a book called Whirlwind.
It's called Rogue One, by the way.
Yes, exactly. You're right. You're exactly right. I didn't think about that. But there's a book called Whirlwind, and it takes place in 1979 during the Iranian Revolution in Iran. And in the book Noble House, a lot is made about how Dunross sends one of his cousins, you know, one of his underling cousins. They're all cousins, you know. He sends one of his underling cousins off to Scotland because oil has been discovered in the North Sea. And he sends him off because he figures out that the way they're going to service those Blofeld-style oil platforms in the North Sea. North Sea? I ain't got nothing in the North Sea. The way they're going to service them is by helicopter. So Dunross opens up a Struan's helicopter division in Scotland to service the North Sea oil platforms. Pretty smart, right? Because he's got he's a big aviation guy. They talk about how Dunross is a race car driver, a horse rider, and he flies helicopters. Because basically, in the miniseries, Pierce Brosnan is awesome. In the book, Ian Dunross is Superman. He can do everything. He has a photographic memory also. Anyway, in fact, in the book, it got to the point I'm like, okay, what else is Ian Dunross great at, right? He thinks about riding Noble Star in the horse race. He's a race car driver. He flies helicopters. He has a photographic memory. He's a genius businessman. He speaks a bunch of languages. He's suave. I mean, he is Superman. So in Whirlwind, it's set in the Iranian Revolution where they've branched their helicopter oil business out into Iran. And I think it's Andrew Gavilan is one of those cousins that gets sent off to do a helicopter thing in Noble House. So Whirlwind is focused mainly on Andrew Gavilan and his buddies in Iran trying to get the hell out of Iran during the revolution. It's a pretty cool story. And it's all about helicopters and stuff. And in it, we get like one conversation between, I think, Gavilan and Ian Dunross. And it's 1979, and you find out that Dunross was Taipan from 1960 to 1970. And in 1970, he tried to hand over the Taipan role to one of the good guy cousins from that you see in Noble House, one of those guys, I forget which, and that guy dies in a mysterious climbing accident. And the only people that were there at the scene of the accident, Jared, were The one that was impudent and didn't want to go off and miss the race. Oh, what's his name? I'm blinking out. There's
Yes, you can.
Linbar Struan. The only people there were Linbar Struan and Paul Choi.
Uh huh.
And Linbar becomes Taipan against Ian Dunross's wishes because he wasn't Taipan anymore. And so Dunross is convinced that Paul Choi and, I just said his name, Linbar. I keep wanting to say Link. Linbar, they conspired to murder the other guy. And I can't think of who the guy is. So we're left with an even bigger mystery than we are at the end of Noble House, and then Clavel died. I've been desperately wishing that the Clavel estate, I know this is terrible and it's heresy and nobody would want this actually. I want a kind of a fan fiction, you know, where we get maybe 1997 or some other period where something important happens and we find out what happens to Linbar Struan and Paul Choi and an older Ian Dunross. I really want to know, but it's all left hanging, dang it.
Well, I know a guy who writes really good space opera and does a lot of this sort of inner family things. And he also wrote a heist novel, so he knows a lot about, you know, ground-based reality. He'd probably be good for this.
Yeah, it ain't going to be me. I have a friend who did a review of the Clavel books years ago. And he wrote, I think, but it's a fan fiction basically set back in the 1800s. So I desperately want one of those continuation novels by a different author where we find out what happens. If maybe it's like with Dune, you know, where they, you know, with the Dune books, Brian Herbert found a safety deposit box with all of Frank Herbert's notes for the rest of the Dune saga. And so he got together with Kevin J. Anderson and they just wrote them. So I kind of want like Frank Clavel or whoever there might be out there to find the notes and get together with, you know, I don't know, some big author and write the freaking sequels. I want to know. But, all right, well, last two things we need to get into and we'll wrap up. There's the fire on the boat. That's a good set piece. Yes. Let's talk about that. We'll talk about the landslide. So the fire, you bring all the big characters together on the boat on a floating restaurant, and then you have a fire breakout. So what did you think about the action sequence in the middle of it?
that was interesting. Because that is one giant boat. I mean, for those of you who haven't seen it or read the book, you might think, floating restaurant. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing was huge. Mm-hmm. It was ginormous. I wouldn't like say it's akin to like a floating McDonald's restaurant. It was like 5-6 stories tall and elaborate, and it made for a great action piece set. You could tell they spent a lot of money on that. By far the best thing that happened during the flaming restaurant, flaming floating restaurant.
Yeah, it's flaming and floating.
Was John Rhys Davies' performance.
Oh, Quillen Gore.
People are running around screaming. There's fire. There's explosions. He's sitting at the bar just tossing back a drink.
Having a drink.
Like he has zero craps to give about what's going on. Right,
he is so awesome in this, isn't he? He is so great in this world.
He is the coolest dude. I'm like, he is out-cooling Pierce Brosnan right now.
Yeah.
And that is saying something.
That is. Because, I mean, in a way, he's like the Bond villain of this whole story, you know. And yet, on another way, he's very sympathetic and you like him, you know. It's weird.
Yes. Every really great story has a really great villain, I feel like. And the perfect casting for this, I think, he's I call it one of the terms I like to use is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
It's an okay movie, but Alan Rickman's performance as the villain puts it way over the top. And I feel like that's what happens here because he is so funny and you almost root for him in a dark way. You know?
Even when he makes moves on Casey that she doesn't want. I mean, he doesn't rape her, but for a second there, you're like, dude, he's going to rape her. And
yeah,
then
I was like, that got dark fast. And then all of a sudden he was like, I'm not going to rape you.
I know. That's
what I am.
I love it. Yeah, she's like freaking out, furious, and he just kind of sits back, ha, 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 you know, and he just totally blows it off. Like, well, we'll still do business. It's all good. And she's like, I hate you. I hate you. You know, and he's just like, oh, have a drink. It's cool. Chill out. You know, he's just like,
you.
Oh my God. he's like, he's almost a Bond villain, but yet he's still kind of likable.
Yeah, and certainly on that fire scene on the floating restaurant, he was cool as a cucumber. Had funny things to say, and again, that scene looked really good. You know, they did a lot of great fire effects, and it was very believable. Great scene. Great scene.
They're standing on the railing. Everybody else has gone off one way or another. It's like they're in this deal where it's like they're playing chicken. Who's going to be the last one to get off? You know. And it gets worse and worse, and they both kind of realize, you know, we kind of both need to get off. But you first, you know what I mean? Who's going to be the first one to go? And I love Dunross, you know, Pierce Brosnan looks at him and says, Quillen, burning to death or drowning with you fills me with an equal disdain.
That's right.
I love it. And at one point, I think, doesn't a keg hit Quillen and knock him down? And
knocks him down. Yeah, takes his feet out from under him.
And Ian doesn't leave him. He wakes him up and helps him get off. And he says basically like, you know, it wouldn't be as much fun without you or something. And then at the end of the story, they come back to that, and Ian kind of gives him a lifeline financially at the very end. And he's like, why are you doing this? And he's like, well, like you said, it wouldn't be interesting. Well, I mean, he says, it wouldn't be as interesting without me, would it? You know, and Dunross is like, no, you know, it wouldn't. So they hate each other, want to destroy each other, but yet when it comes to cases, they're kind of buddies in a way almost. It's
they just weird. Don't want to be bored.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, they just don't want each other out. So you get the great swan dive, and I got to mention in the book it explains. They talk about in the miniseries too that Kowloon Harbor is like the filthiest toilet on. It's like if you went into the worst men's room in a gas station and jumped into the toilet. Okay, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And this is another way that the main characters are all supermen and women. Everybody else in the story, in the book, that jumps in that harbor gets like dysentery and nearly dies. And Casey and Ian Dunross and all of them, they're fine.
Don't go swimming in Hepatitis Harbor, y'all.
No. Well, it's funny. They all go see this. Ian takes them all to this doctor that night. And he gives them all this stuff that just makes them violently throw up and have diarrhea. And the doctor's like, you may still get sick after this, but there won't be much left in you to cause anything after I'm done with you, basically. You know, I'm just going to clean you out. And anything that's in there that could cause a problem won't be in there anymore. And, you know, I don't know how accurate that really would be because germs are germs. But he just cleans them out. And they're like, because it's like the next day they see each other and they're all just looking at you like, oh, God. So, all right. So the flaming restaurant, and they survive that. Except I think in the book, the newspaper reporter guy's wife gets killed. But that's about it. Okay, so then we get to the big finale, which is you got to move all the pieces together on the board so that Clavel can knock down the ones he wants to knock down, right? So they're all around this big apartment building, and there's a landslide. Cause it's been raining and raining and raining. In fact, in the book, they make a big deal out of how for the first half of the book, it's a drought. In fact, let me tell you, this is funny real quick. When Casey first goes to meet all the Struans people, she goes to the restroom. And she goes in the restroom, and she's amazed as an American at how it's kind of grungy and everything. It's like, this is this great business company in Hong Kong. All these British guys, they just think they're the crap, you know. And their bathroom is really grungy, and there's these buckets of water everywhere. She's like, what is the deal with this? So she tries to flush the toilet, and there's no water in the toilet. And so she's like, oh, gosh, I guess I'm supposed to use a bucket of water to flush the toilet. How you know, these guys act like they're so superior, but yet their bathroom, you have to use a bucket of water to flush the toilet. So she pours like a whole bucket of water in the toilet, flushes the toilet, and then she uses another bucket of water to like wash her face off or something. Or she uses a lot of water, okay, from these buckets. She gets back in the boardroom, and they're talking about how, man, this drought's going to go on forever. It's a good thing we have plenty of water stowed away in buckets in the restroom so we can all use the bathroom for the next week. And Casey's like, oh, crap. And she just doesn't say a word. She's like, woohoo, la la la. Because they're going to be in for a surprise when they go, there's no water. So, but, all right, so everybody's in this apartment building, and now the drought is over, and it's pouring down rain, and there's a mudslide. And so this apartment building crashes down and is destroyed, and it really kind of takes out the people that Clavel needed taken out, you know what I mean? So Four Finger Wu was up there visiting Venus Poon in more ways than one, I'm sure, and he's dead. And Paul Choi finds the coin around his body, on his neck, right around his neck, on his body. So now Paul Choi's got the freaking coin. It just that coin gets passed around more than the diseases in the harbor in this movie.
Or Venus Boone.
Or Venus Boone, yes. Good one. Very good, yeah. And what about Link? Because that was the big thing here. What do you think about? Because Link and Orlando have basically declared their love for each other. He's going to take her away with him. Her years of being sad and alone in Hong Kong, and I just can't imagine Julia Nixon was ever sad and alone in Hong Kong, but her years of being sad and alone in Hong Kong are over. She's got her golden ticket. She's going to ride out with Link. She spent like half the miniseries seducing him, but then realizes it's not really just seduction. She really does, you know, love him, and he loves her. Everything's going to be great. Link is like, man, you know, American women are awesome, but this lady is just like, she's devoted to me. She wants to rub my feet for an hour every night and doesn't, you know.
At one point, she offered to buy him a prostitute.
Yes, exactly. Well, see, that's all part of her plan. She's like, I can't sleep with you, Link. That would be wrong. But I can buy you a hooker. And he's like, what? And so it's you get this great, yeah. I mean, that's one thing Clavel is great at is Asian culture and Western culture colliding. That's the main theme of all of his books at the core, is what happens when European culture, Americans are always like idiots, right? But European culture and Asian cultures collide because it's understood that the Chinese all think the Europeans are idiots, right? Barbarians. And the Europeans all think the Chinese are bizarre alien barbarians. And they think that of each other. And what Clavel is always pushing in all of these stories is better together, right? That when they get together and they try to understand each other, they can do great things. And the worst thing is when they don't like each other and have xenophobia. So that's the theme he's always pushing in all these stories, is the Chinese, the Asians, and the Europeans, Americans need to get together and help each other's strengths rather than hating each other and being ignorant. Okay? And you can kind of see that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what Bartlett is discovering. He's a ugly American, you know, loudmouth American who comes, not as much as the superfoods guy, who comes over and he gets civilized by Orlando, just like Dirk Struan back in 1840 got civilized by May May. Again, that's a theme that runs through it. I would tell you this, the one problem about King Rat is that it's a prison camp, so there's no women. So you don't get a gorgeous Asian woman who teaches, you know, Philip Marlowe and the king how to be more civilized. That's the one thing. It's what makes King Rat different from all the other Clavel stories, is it's all men, and you never get that woman who civilizes the barbarian story like you do in basically all the other, you know, stories. So we have to pause for just a second to thank our patrons who keep our programs on the air and allow us to bring shows like this to you. You can join them and also be on this list in every episode of our various programs for as little as $1 a month by going to Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com, and looking up Van Allen Plexico, or just Plexico would take you to me pretty much, or go to www.plexico, P-L-E-X-I-C-O.net. We want to thank Joseph Fine, Christopher Burleson, and Samuel Salvatore. And then we need to thank Stephen Thompson, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Justin Bean, Chris Usher, David Evers, Tom Anderson, Timothy, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Steve Harlan, Andrew Barber, Jared Albright, Rich Reimer, Bill Matthews, Will Summerford, John McCune, Catherine England, Ann Congian, Auburn Tiger Talk, Clay Henson, David Simpson, Josh Teal, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Earl Ricks, Dave Powell, Michael Kirshner, Mick Vigicana, Matt Robenheimer, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, George Gaston, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Jason Albright, J.W. Rice, Ward Amway, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Russell Milling, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Brant Rumble, Nicholas Craig, Patrick Williams, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Ben Amos, Randall Walker, and Joshua Corbett, plus our one-time and anonymous donors. That's www.patreon.com or www.plexico.net. We appreciate it, and you keep us going, and we could not exist and do these shows without you. So the landslide, what did you make out of all that?
I thought it was very, and I guess I was onto something based on what you've told me. I thought it was like very abrupt. Like it, yeah. it felt like, oh, we got to wrap some things up here.
Mm-hmm. So, it does. Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's kind of his MO.
Because I'm still sitting here thinking, is Quillen going to go to jail for having that jockey murdered, or what's going on with that? Which nobody really ever spoke of again.
That's true.
By the way,
yeah.
I'm like, wait, isn't he going to go to jail anyway? So this landslide happens, and like I said, the most unlucky billionaire on the planet gets caught up in the middle of it.
Yep. And lives through it at first, but. Just long enough to basically pledge his love for Orlando.
Yeah.
And ask Ian to be his best man. I forget, in the book is something about how hard is it to get a marriage license, or maybe it's in the miniseries.
Yeah, they talk about that. Yeah.
I think in the miniseries he asks about getting a marriage license. In the book he asks Ian about being because in the book he asks Ian about being his best man. And Ian reports that to Orlando and to Casey, and the both of the women are like, "Was that for me?" Because see, it's not as clear in the book which one he settled on, and then later Casey kind of says, "You know, it was Orlando. He was asking Dunross to be his. It wasn't me, right?" She does a lot of soul searching, and she's like, "It wasn't me. He was totally gone for her," and so. I mean, let's talk about the landslide, and then I want to kind of wrap up the things that happens with her. So, so Four Finger Wu dead, Link. What did you think about how that all played out in terms of how it resolved all the outstanding issues?
Well, like I said, I thought it was very abrupt, especially after going through like 6 hours of many series. I was like, wait, whoa, okay. And I'm glad you told me what you told me, that this is a theme of Clavel, that is a big kind of shake them up thing usually at the buzzer there.
Yeah.
So I found it to be abrupt, but the dark part of me did have to laugh that Link is the most unlucky billionaire guy on the planet, because he's like, finally, I know what I want. I've got a plan. I'm dead.
Yep.
You got to wonder whatever became of Orlando.
Yeah.
Although I like to think things got better for her. I think she was very hesitant to love because she had loved someone before, and that's what had.
But he was a jerk. That was Quillen. Yeah.
With Quillen. And I think that guy ended up like killing himself or something. It was jacked up.
Yeah, it was.
I think it taught her that her and Quillen kind of both of a lesson that they could part their ways. But unfortunately, Link had to pay that price. But yeah, just to answer your question though, on the Protestants, very abrupt, but well done. I thought the performances were good, and the effects were good. So
yeah, I think it's like you say about the unluckiest guy. It's like God told Link Bartlett, okay, the good news is you're a billionaire and these two gorgeous women are basically fighting over you. The bad news is
you're going to discover true love. Yeah. And you're going to be so excited for it. Here's the downside.
Landslide. Yeah, boy. So they kind of really squeeze it tight in the miniseries. They do it very quickly. The denouement after that. But in the book, what you find out is that Casey kind of comes to she kind of accepts that Link loved Orlando. But in the book, Orlando is still always thinking of Casey as the enemy, right? Orlando doesn't like Casey. She doesn't want anything to do with her. She thinks Casey's her competition. She's her enemy. She's out to destroy her so she can have Link for herself. And so this is one of my favorite parts of the whole thing, is at the end, Casey goes and meets with Orlando. And Orlando's like, why do you even want to meet with me? Orlando's thinking, why does my enemy want to see me? Does she want to rub it in? You know, Orlando's like drawing all the wrong conclusions. He's like, oh, Casey wants to just do a little victory dance. Ha ha, you don't get him either. You know, spike the football in the end zone, all that. And so Orlando is absolutely blindsided that Casey is like, Link wanted you to have money. And she's like, I don't want your money, Casey. She's like, it's not my money. It's Link's money. He wanted you to be taken care of. Here's a bunch of money. And why don't you come back with me to Los Angeles? Because you could probably be big there, you know, whereas here you're just another, you know, just another Chinese woman trying to get a job, basically. Whereas in Los Angeles, you could be like, you know, a reporter, a businesswoman, an actress, whatever, you know, and be big. So And she's like, I'll take you back with me. And Orlando's just kind of like her mouth's hanging up. She's like, you would do this for me? Why? And she says, because we both love Link, and he loved you, and so I feel kind of obligated to make sure that you're okay, you know. And Orlando just can't believe it. It's just a really cool human, you know, emotional thing there.
I think in the miniseries they sold more towards the Ian Dunross and Casey relationship. So yeah. I think you lost a little bit of that from the book in the miniseries. But it did play through a little bit. I mean, I did see that, but I think from what you're telling me, the book sounds like they were a lot more adversarial than they were in the miniseries. Yeah. They were a little adversarial in the miniseries, but it seemed about halfway through that Casey was like, okay, all right. Mm-hmm. Link's going to do what he's going to do. I'm going to hang out with super charming Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, and you know, that's a big part of it too, is in the miniseries, you don't get all this, we've been waiting years to get together and it's almost time. You also,
that didn't play at all.
And in the miniseries, you also don't get near as much romance between Casey and Ian Dunross. Because that, let me fill this part in too. Okay, this is leading us up to the very last thing. In the book, Ian Dunross is happily married with grown kids and teenage kids.
Oh, okay.
He's got a daughter that's like running around with a reporter, and Dunross is constantly like, you need to find somebody better. And she's like, oh, but father, oh, just give me the Ferrari and it'll all be fine. You know, he's like, okay, take the Ferrari, you know. So it's he's got a family relationship, but he does appreciate Casey. And there's just a tiny little bit of a spark there. But at the end, Casey is very independent. She's not, you know, beholden to anybody. And Orlando go back to Los Angeles, and by the way, this ties in. I think I hadn't thought about this until I said it just now, but this ties in very effectively to the end of Taipan, because at the end of Taipan, when Struan is dead, his European son, is supposed to take over, but Quillen Gorn's ancestor steps in and says, lad, you're not remotely ready yet, you know, and he's been a very shy, quiet, nebbish kid the whole story. I'll run everything for you. Don't you worry at all. You know, I know you're engaged to my daughter, and that's great, but I'm going to take her back to my ship with me, and you don't worry, I'm going to run everything. And there's this moment, this great moment at the end of Taipan, where some random guy comes up to the kid and says, well, you know, that was quite a storm, eh, Taipan? And he's like, wait, what did you call me? He says, Taipan. You're the Taipan now, right? You run the whole place. And the kid is kind of like, son of a gun, I'm the Taipan now. And he calls up one of his sailors and says, go aboard Gorn's ancestors' ship and fetch my wife or my fiance. And fetch? Like, yes. Mm-hmm. In other words, go up to the Bond villain of this story and take his daughter away and fetch her back to me. I'm going to be her husband, and I'm in charge now. And tell him he's not doing anything. I'm doing it. So you get kind of a similar thing here, right, with the lawyer, with Seymour, where Seymour says, I'm going to handle everything. I'm in charge. Casey, you just don't worry your pretty little head. And what does Casey say?
Basically, I got it.
You're fired. You're fired, yeah, Seymour. Get out of here.
You're good to go.
You're good to go. I'm in charge. Yeah. And so she fetches Orlando and takes her back to Los Angeles. Yeah. So that's another, I guess, I hadn't thought about it before. It's another neat Clavell thread that he likes, you know, is the idea that,
Are you telling me that Ian Dunross and Casey don't have a relationship in the book, or that he like cheats on his wife in the book?
No, he kind of looks at her and he admires her, and there's a little spark, but you never get them going to bed or
anything
like
that.
Oh, okay,
that's hugely different.
Hugely different. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And see, in Taipan, Struan had his mistress because his wife was back in Scotland and then died of the plague, but here, his wife is right there, and she's actually pretty nice. I'm trying to think.
Change.
You're not going to believe this, Jared. I hadn't even thought of this till now. Dunross's wife, this is how these characters in these books are so intertwined. I hadn't even thought about this till now. In the book, Dunross's wife, who is a fine woman, and he likes her, he loves her. Dunross's wife's brother, you're not going to believe who Dunross's wife's brother is in the book.
Just lay it on me.
Robin, the camp guard from King Rat. Remember the jerk, the one that's always trying to catch him doing bad stuff?
Yes.
Did you just hate him?
Yes.
That's Dunross's brother-in-law. And he shows up with, he's a member of parliament. Oh, this is, you'll love this. You will love this. He's a Labour Party left-wing socialist member of the British Parliament in the 60s. And he shows up with some other members of parliament, and he's as loudmouth of a jerk as ever. And Ian is just like, oh, my brother-in-law, good God.
This guy.
And okay, and you remember the British main character in King Rat, the prisoner, mm-hmm. the guy we like that's with the king?
Yep.
He is James Clavell. And he's in Hong Kong writing a novel about Hong Kong. And he's hanging out with Dunross and the others to gather information to write a book about the Struan family fictionalized, because Clavell went to Hong Kong and gathered information to write a book about the fictionalized Jardine Matheson family, which he calls Struan. So wheels within wheels within wheels, okay?
Oh, my goodness, there's levels
right
here.
So Peter Marlowe, I just remembered his name, Peter Marlowe is there, and Dunross's brother-in-law shows up, and they just look at each other like, you son of a... They hate each other. Oh my gosh. And they're like, we haven't seen each other in, you know, since Changi, which in that point is like 18 years since 45. And they just hate each other. Oh man. So I'd forgotten there's that whole subplot. It's a 1400 page freaking book. I'm holding it right now. It's almost as thick as it is wide. So there's just so many subplots they couldn't get into or wouldn't have even made sense, you know? All right, so the very last scene, and it's just like it in the book and in the miniseries, is Dunross drives his racy car all the way up to the top of the mountain to the Dunross estate, and he walks out onto the balcony, and he watches Casey's airplane, the Parcon plane, take off and fly away. And in the miniseries, you hear that sweeping Noble House score that I love. I love the music in this thing. Mm-hmm. As he looks out and the camera pans around behind him to show all of Hong Kong Harbor, and it's just like Pierce Brosnan is the man. He's back in charge of Hong Kong again. He's got a hot woman that may be flying back to him in like a month, right? And they said, like, you go take a month to get things squared away. Mm-hmm. Basically go get Orlando a job, you know, square your business away. And then she says, I'll come back.
He was really smart. He'd ask her to return with Orlando, but that's good just planning.
Yeah, right. And so in the book, the camera of your mind basically swings around, and Dunross is on the balcony on the railing looking out, and the last line is, "Christ, it's so good to be alive." And I just always love that last line, because it's like saying, with James Clavell being your author, if you make it to the end of the book, it's so good to be alive.
Just ask Link Bartlett.
Exactly. Yeah. And Link Bartlett, yeah, the last line could be, in parentheses, Link Bartlett's like, dang it, I'm dead. Dang it. All right. So last thoughts on Noble House.
Let me hit the high points. Mm-hmm. Let's end it on the positive. Here's the things I really liked about it. You got Pierce Brosnan, 1988. That's like smack dab in the middle of the greatest James Bond years ever, the Dalton years. No comments out of you. So he's on the cusp of mega stardom.
Yep.
Always interesting to see actors before that happens. I thought supporting cast wise, Burt Kwok is always a welcome addition. John Rhys Davies, we talked about that. He is the icing on the cake of this whole miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Ping Wu, who played Four Finger Wu's nephew/son. We talked about Gordon Jackson as the police investigator, him and Chu Toy. A lot of really good, and Julian Nixon. Those were the big standouts for me as far as the actors go. A lot of good performances throughout there. The other big compliment I'll give it is it is very much a big boardroom business drama, which if you put that down to me on paper, I'd be like, I might watch it, I might not. But it is done in such a way that it did stay engaging through 6 hours of watching. So in the end, I'm glad I watched it.
Well, here's a couple of things. One, James Clavell said this of the adaptation. He says, I never really want to doctor my work for TV, but we had a problem with Noble House. There are so many subplots and interwoven characters that we had to drop some things. We felt the changes would work well, and I approved it. Eric, and that's Eric Bercovici, the screenwriter director, he goes through the book and literally tears out many of the lesser characters. There's no way it can be done otherwise. I hope Noble House will do for Hong Kong what Shogun did for Japan. In my opinion, it remains the queen city of Asia and will go on forever despite the changes coming up the next few years. And then lastly, and for you, I'll point this out too, he talks about the casting. He says, Pierce Brosnan simply fell into our lap when he couldn't do the 007 job.
There you go.
So, all right. Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It's one of my favorite stories. It's one of my favorite authors. It's one of my favorite actors. There's just so much about this that hits me. You know, it's history, it's spying and espionage, it's politics. It's got
Julian Nixon.
It's got Julian Nixon, who is fantastic. Yeah, met her at Dragon Con a few years ago. Wonderful woman. Yeah, so it really is just like the perfect story for me. And I know it's a big ask for anybody out there to, if you're not big on giant books, but this book is very rewarding, even in all the details. Even though we've given away a lot of the bigger plot points, there's just so much. There's so many details, so much stuff to it, that it's worth reading even separately from seeing the miniseries. They're like two different things. There's a lot in common, there's a lot different, and there's just so much more to it. If only for the Inspector Cross double agents plotline. That alone is... And there's a couple of Russian characters that you actually follow through the story as well, trying to serve Mother Russia, you know, and trying to find sneaky ways to subvert American sailors from the aircraft carrier and stuff. There's just a lot to it. So it's a wonderful, wonderful story. All right. Well, I think that will do it, and we will wrap things up. The Rocket will get on out of here for another episode. Jared, I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate you giving this great long story a chance.
Hey, no problem. One of these days you'll have to try one of the, 90-minute movies that I've sent to you.
We'll do it. We got them coming up. And we got to get back to our Babylon 5 and Quantum Leap shows. We just haven't had time.
Yes, I've had a couple people ask me about that offline. When are these coming back? So, yeah we definitely got to get back to that.
Absolutely. All right, well, The Rocket's going to get out of here for another episode. We'll see you guys down the road.
Bye.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.